show. We solved the flatness constraints, which are actually also the include the Hamiltonian constraints. And so as we remarked before, it means that you actually solve completely have to solve the dynamics. So it's like the equivalent of solving the Schrödinger equation for quantum mechanics. So we did it. And so the result was that actually for two states, tetrahedral states, based on a tetrahedral graph, we got something, the product I of these dimension factors, so it's the dimension of the representation. And then we had the 6J symbols. And so let me write it 6J prime and 6J. And yeah, you can, and so this we interpreted as a transition amplitude, where you have to take it a bit carefully what it means. And so you could say it's a probability to go from one tetrahedral state to another one and back, actually. And you could also take a tetrahedron with zero edge lengths, and then it would be basically the transition amplitude from a state describing zero spatial geometry to a tetrahedron to a sphere. And however, to point out one interesting or one remark is actually that we said, so we are in a spherical case. You can do the same, similar things for other topologies of your spatial manifold. But you see here that actually there's a funny feature, which is a bit unusual for transition amplitudes. It's that the amplitude completely factorizes. The product of two things, you know, it's kind of. Product of two amplitudes, but there are no correlations between these things. So you don't sum over anything. It's just the product of two amplitudes. And so this is actually a sign that you have 0 degrees of freedom, or it means that your state, that your physical Hilbert space is actually just one-dimensional. There's only one physical state. And this one physical state yeah, it depends on whether you take these dimension factors with you or not. It's a function of the j's only. So now here the j's are parameters. Here the j's are just function. And it's given by the 6j amplitude. And why is that an indication that this factorizing amplitude tells you that your Hilbert space is one-dimensional, your physical Hilbert space is one-dimensional. The reason is you cannot find two states which would have zero product. Because it's always, you know, it's always a product of two non-vanishing numbers. And so there's no orthogonal, you cannot find two states which are orthogonal to each other. So it's like having two vectors and one vector, and so the only thing which you do is you multiply with them with different numbers, and you get CC prime if this vector V is normalized. And so this is, however, what you expect, because there's basically zero Dirac observables in the spherical case, but for the torus you have four Dirac observables, I would say. Or two, I don't remember. And for higher genus, you have even more Dirac observables. And in these cases, you would find states which are orthogonal to each other. But the physical inner product looks actually very similar, that you have to build it up from 6J symbols. And so to give you a 3-minute introduction to path integrals, actually these 6J symbols also turn up to be to give you the path integral for 3D. And so to motivate that, we have seen that you have the BF action. And so what you do is you try to in the path integral, you integrate over the B fields and over the connection fields in principle. And however, I noted a number of times maybe that this BF action looks quite simple because it looks like exponential I p q, and you integrate over actually here, you integrate, q, you have a function of q here, but you integrate over dp, and this, is kind of related to the delta function of f of q. So indeed, there's a more precise procedure to discretize these expressions and to integrate formally out the dB, the B fields. And so what do we get if you integrate out the B fields? You get a delta function as a curvature. And so actually, now you can write the Now you can actually write this discretization by saying, I have a product over phases in my triangulation. So if you discretize, you have a triangulation. And actually, it's not phases in your triangulation, but it's phases in your dual triangulation. And so if you're in 3D, the dual triangulation is putting a vertex here. It's a bit difficult to draw. It's putting a vertex to every tetrahedron inside the tetrahedron. Connecting neighboring tetrahedra means that you will have edges dual to faces. And then you will have faces in the dual, which actually go around these edges in the triangulation. Actually, is this, you mean this function or this function? Or so this wave function, this is actually, or this is supposed to be, there's no group elements here anymore. It's so that's actually, it's just a function of six spin labels, and that's given by the 6J symbol.
Wave functions are non-physical, right?
Say what?
They are non-physical. They are non-gauge invariant in general. I mean, they just get multiplied by a phase or by a unitary transformation. But so in this case, we have a, I mean, the wave function happens to be physical, something that eventually I could measure.
Ah, yeah, so in this case, it's a bit difficult to discuss because what you would need is at least two physical wave functions.
Okay.
And then you could ask for the transition amplitude. But this actually gives you, so even in this, so in the more general, say you have a torus, and then this formula, which we discussed yesterday, of computing the physical inner product would give you the kind of, for instance, the transition amplitude between these two states. And so the states themselves are actually kinematical. but they give you actually the transition amplitude of the corresponding physical states. And so this would be something gauge invariant. I mean, yeah, gauge invariant.
Another question related to what we did before. So we have this spin network, and if I make gauge transformation, let's say I choose the time direction, and I let it evolve, so the triangulation of my manifold might change, right? So does that imply that I can have change of topology?
That's a good question. So it depends on how you define things. It's already, you know, so you could consider this path integral, which includes a change of topology, and actually, I mean, in a different setup, people did it to also do string theory, but this was supposed dynamical triangulation.
Right.
But there might be some conditions. Actually, the Lorentzian case is not as easy.
Because so it confuses me, because if time evolution is just another gauge transformation, which is a deep morphism, then that's a continuous transformation, right? There is no way that I can change topology.
Yeah, no, indeed. I mean, you wouldn't, if you would be a very canonical person, you would rather not allow the topology change. But, you know, there's still busy lots of discussions, or lots, I mean, at some point, people try to implement topology change, at least in the path integral. And it's a bit easier to discuss in the path integral, but in principle, you could also, you know, define some kind of weird unitary transformations. Actually, we're doing something similar, or we did something similar, with where it's already the question, how do you change from, you know, because in this case, the number of physical degrees of freedom would even change. And so in 4D, this happens all the time. In principle, if you really just consider the discretized theory, and then, you know, then you have to have a formalism in which the number of degrees of freedom is allowed to change. And there is such a formalism, but it's a bit outside, like, the textbook quantum mechanics. Okay.
I'll try to be quick. So when you mentioned the torus, you said there's distinct states.
Yeah.
So we can actually calculate transition amplitude. How do I interpret the transition amplitude?
Yeah, that's a good question. No, then... So for this, I don't know if David will give you this tutorial.
Probably not.
Sorry, he gave up on this homework. But this was giving you, I mean, then you could count, you would have seen that you get, for instance, four physical states in the case of that two gauge group. And so you actually would have to work out the Dirac, these complete observables. And like understand these complete observables, and they give you something physical. It's actually that the torus universe evolves in some way, which I'm not really aware of right now. But I mean, it does something like it maybe expands or something. And for instance, you have two observables, like the length of these non-contractible curves. And so, but these are not really constant in time, so they are not Dirac observables yet. But then you could still do this complete observables and think of some time or some relation observables, for instance, one length of the curve in relation to the other. And so this would allow to give you, to label the states with some labels which tell you something physical, like a property of the state. And yeah, that's how you actually interpret the state. So in cosmology, you know, what people do is to use a scalar field as time variable. And then they express basically different volumes at different scalar field values as a time evolution. it's a bit, I mean, then it's basically just a question whether states overlap, or because if you have a diagonal basis in these Dirac observables and they stay constant, then they don't really overlap, or you don't have a transition, then the physical inner product is just zero between them. Okay. What's up?
No, it was just a curiosity now that you mentioned the fact that there are four things in the torus. does it has to do with, I mean, can this be related to topological order, condensed matter, and this?
Yeah, no, that was, so you can ask.
I'll give you the
no,
floor.
No. I still have to send you the last piece of the lecture notes anyway, and there is this homework. And it's busy. It's the same theory. Actually, it's just the same theory, the topological order, just that because condensed matter people are even more lazy than me, so they choose like typically finite groups, and the Skitaev code is that too. It's the simplest group you can think of, and so this tutorial homework was there that you actually apply it and transfer your knowledge to this set two case. And then it's really, then it's more for sale. Okay, so you have your faces. And here, so the connection, you actually discretize with holonomies. And so you have holonomies associated to the dual edges also, GE. And actually, what you have is it's the nicest sparse integral you can imagine modulo some divergences, because this is this is just a bunch of delta functions over faces. And so indeed, it's actually lattice gauge theory at the zero coupling in a sense. And so this is HF. Goes around this edge, and so you have this path integral. And now you can do a group Fourier transform. And what you write is this nice looking path integral, you rewrite it into a bunch of complicated looking stuff. And this is given as a sum over the spin labels. So the group Fourier transform would also introduce representation labels and the magnetic indices. And the magnetic indices are, however, all contracted with each other. And this contraction process, surprise, surprise, produces actually the 6J symbols and some dimensions. Course. And so here, something, then it should be E. So don't take it, I mean, there might, I'm not sure, I think there, okay, so it should be this space. So it's tetrahedra. It's actually the tetrahedra and the triangulation. And so for every edge in your tetrahedra, you have this dimension factor, and you have a 6J symbol associated to this tetrahedra. And so you see that this vacuum amplitude we found appears, it's associated to one tetrahedron, and actually it also appears as the amplitude in your path integral. And indeed, if you make an asymptotic analysis, you find that in the large J limit, and yeah, you can ask Ilya about the details, you find the so-called Rege action, which is a discretization of the gravity action. And actually, so here you see that you can actually derive the path integral. I mean, that's the path integral and this canonical approach, in principle, get you to the same result. And why? So I'm not going to go through the detailed calculation, because it's really a bit too much detail. But to motivate why you get the 6J symbols is that I think I might have mentioned that the delta function you can actually write as a sum over the so-called characters of the group. And so you do that, and then this can be actually, these characters are just traces of representation matrices. And so you actually just expand this. Into representation matrices, and then these magnetic indices get all contracted with each other. Actually, the integrating out of these things gives you these three JM symbols. Integrating over G gives you three JM symbols, and the magnetic indices get basically contracted in these three JM. Three J M symbols to the six J symbols, and that's a bit more derivation where you have to sit down. But this tells you something about the path integral for 3D, and it's actually also the path integral for 4D. However, it's a topological theory, and you do some weird steps to arrive at a path integral for 4D. Another thing is that here you don't really care about this redundancy of delta functions. And actually, this path integral is completely undefined. And you get actually at least one divergence. That is a divergence for every inner vertex in your triangulation. And actually, that is a sign that you really represent a diffeomorphism symmetry, because you actually here integrate also over the diffeomorphism symmetry orbits, and these are non-compact, so that's why you get a highly divergent result. But you could gauge fix, and if you gauge fix, this is actually equivalent to looking at the most coarse-grained triangulation possible. And this is nice. I mean, nice about the feature about 3D gravity that really this discretization is not a problem. And this is because it's a topological theory, and topological information is, you know, global information. And so it doesn't really care whether you discretize or not. You can, if you do it correctly, you can manage to transfer all this topological information to your discretization. And this completely changes for 4D gravity. And so in the last 35 minutes, I might try to tell you a bit about 4D gravity. And 4D gravity is interacting, so you have degrees of freedom at all scales. And so typically, discretization means that you do some error, so, because you typically approximate. And okay, so there are also first order action for 4D gravity, but they are a bit more complicated to analyze, because they all either involve some gauge fixing, which you need to do, or second-class constraints. However, to just tell you what actually the variables are, which are almost the same as in 3D gravity, with a little trick, I try to just explain you that basically with this stuff you learned about 3D, you can already do a lot of 4D gravity. And so let's consider, you know, in 3D, if you do the so-called ADM formalism, which means you take really the Einstein action and do canonical analysis, that's called ADM. And what you conclude is that the initial data in this case are given by the 3 metric, which we had also at some point. And the so-called extrinsic curvature of your 3D manifold in 4D. And so this extrinsic curvature describes you how your 3D manifold is embedded into your 4D manifold. And so these would be just initial values which would allow you to evolve them into solution. You have, of course, also the usual constraints. So in this case, you have still Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraint, which are part, you know, in 3D, they're all included in the flatness constraint. And so now these are 3D indices. And so now you do the same as in 3D. You actually introduce triads, co-triads. And so that's why you also have SO2 algebra indices and 4D. And then you introduce the so-called densitized fluxes, or that Q be the inverse. So this is really the triad, or the inverse co-triad. And furthermore, you introduce this variable, which is just the contraction of the extrinsic curvature with your triad. And so you would say that, you know, these are almost canonically conjugated variables. However, this is a tensor. It's not a connection. And so there's a question, I mean, how to write a connection, because people wanted to write a connection. I mean, the historical root was, of course, quite different from this one. And so basically the main insight from Ashika is that a funny combination, namely here you take the spin connection. So the spin connection still, in this case, the spin connection can be completely written as a function of these triads or of these triads. So it's still just spatial information, no momentum, no information about the extrinsic curvature. but then it turns out, so this makes this capital A into a connection. And if you add a tensor to a connection, it will still transform as a connection. Because the connection has affine or affine. So it has some part which goes as dg, g minus 1. And the other part is just transforms as a tensor, which you add here. So if you add another tensor, you still get something which transforms as a connection. And so what you add is actually the extrinsic curvature. And so you do that with this funny parameter, which is called either Emirsi or Barbero-Emirsi parameter. Barbero. Hope I don't have too many misspellings. Emirsi. And it's quite a non-trivial calculation to actually convince yourself, or that the non-trivial calculation is actually to see that these are actually commuting, because it's not very obvious. Because you have defined an object which is a mixture between the Q variables and the K variables. And these a priori are non-commuting. However, if you take this combination, they're actually commuting. And so you can actually take them as canonical variables. So the E's are commuting, but this is just because, you know, they are just like the configuration variables or pure momentum variables, depending on what you define to be configuration or momentum. And these things now, again, depending on definitions and so on, so some people rescale the fluxes by gamma, and then you would get one here. But here you get gamma just because it's in front of here. And you get, I don't know, JK BA delta function. And so these are exactly the same Poisson relations we had in 3D, modulo this gamma parameter. And this defines your classical phase space. And you have also constraints, which I mentioned later. Oh, no. And so you would actually now quantize it very similar to what we did again in 3D. So not very surprisingly, the connection turns into holonomies associated to curves. the more complicated objects are now the fluxes, which are now associated to surfaces. And so if you take actually the so-called simplicial fluxes, you want to add basically some kind of flux over a surface to this end, you again have to parallel transport it to a common reference frame. And here first the star E is kind of a dualization of your vector densities. And if you dualize a vector density, you get a two form. So it has two indices here. You get a two form, which you can integrate over a surface. And this HP, you consider a surface. So because you do the simplicial fluxes, you actually have some more conventions. Which is that the surface cuts an edge transversely, and this P is a parallel. You have to actually choose a system of parallel transport along the surface, and so this parallel transport, this path goes from a point in the surface to the source vertex of gamma. But this is a simplicial fluxus, so there's a more standard definition which wouldn't need that. But it just to do it equivalently to the 3D case, this is what you get. And if you define these things, then the Poisson algebra between these fluxes and the holonomies are exactly the same as we had in 3D. So you find exactly the same Poisson algebra. And that's why you get exactly the same kinematical Hilbert space as we did in 3D. And now you also see that you need surfaces, because if you're in 3D, you take your dual graph and say it's four-valent. And then you draw some surfaces around it, which are now a bit difficult to draw. And for some reason, I should. Bit impossible to draw, but maybe you get the idea. So you get here three triangles, which are cutting through these edges. And so on top, these give you actually another triangle, which you can't really see. And so actually, then you have the Gauss constraint. And the Gauss constraint tells you again that these triangles actually close to a tetrahedron. And in this case, the interpretation is that these flux variables give you actually the normals to, not the normalized normals, but the normals multiplied with the area. Normals to the surface, and in this case of a triangle, of a four-valent vertex, the surface you can interpret as a triangle. And then this Gauss constraint is also that the sum of these normals vanishes, and that's actually the case for a geometric simple tetrahedron. If you multiply the unit normal with the area of your surface. Unfortunately, this simplicial interpretation doesn't really work completely through all these little details, which work differently in 4D than in 3D. But let's not comment on this, but go on and maybe look at the constraints. And so classically, you mentioned the Gauss constraint, which turns out to be this. And it looks a bit similar to the 3D case, but in fact, because you take actually the Aschecker connection, you not only have the spin connection here, but yeah, the Aschecker connection. And so this means that you have also the extrinsic curvature here. So these are the Gauss constraints. And then there's the so-called diffeomorphism constraint, so the spatial diffeomorphism constraint. And so it comes with an index, it's three constraints, and S is a signature of space-time, so I think it's minus one for Lorentzian, plus one for Euclidean. And so you get a contraction of your curvature tensor with a flux or with a densitized co-triad, densitized triad. And so this looks, you know, quite similar to 3D. However, the 4D Hamiltonian, again, it involves a curvature. Here you have the so-called Euclidean part of the Hamiltonian, and it's a contraction with F, and actually this gives you the normal to these two fluxes, and so this is supposed to be a time at some point a time-like normal, and there's another part, which however vanishes if you choose gamma squared to be S. And unfortunately, for the Euclidean part, it means gamma equal to 1. However, for Lorentzian part, it means that we have gamma to choose imaginary. And that turns out to be a slight problem. If you choose gamma in this way, you actually get gravity in self-dual variables. And so it looks much nicer. But since it's complex, it involves complex variables, in this case, it's bit harder to treat. And here you have a more complicated term because you have to express these extrinsic curvatures in terms of the holonomies and the spin connection, which itself is a complicated function of these densitized triads. And here you have the same term. And so this is the Hamiltonian. And the important part is that it only requires some components of the curvature tensor to be zero, but it doesn't require the curvature tensor to be zero itself. So you have four constraints, but it doesn't really impose F equal to zero. So this is called the Hamiltonian constraint. And so you can deal with the Gauss constraint quite easily, as we did in 3D. The diffeomorphism constraint can be also dealt with in an abstract way. And so one is left with the Hamiltonian constraint. and you have to think about how to quantize this Hamiltonian constraint. And so I will only speak about this first part. This part can also quantize in principle, but since already the first part is quite complicated, let's just look at this. And so you define basically the Smeard constraint. Okay, there's a kappa, which I set to 1. Here you have the lapse function. So this is a smearing parameter that q, you have curvature epsilon jkl EA. EBL. And in a sense, you try to discretize it and to apply it to your spin network states on a given graph. So you can, what you do is, in a sense, a graph-adapted discretization. And here, this, you can rewrite this term, you can rewrite into form which already looks a bit more applicable to quantum theory. So you can write this as trace. The trace is over these indices, the two form of the curvature. And here it's the commutator of Lie algebra valued forms. And so the most complicated part here is always this 1 over determinant q, because it's a highly non-polynomial function of your triad variables. And it was completely unclear how to quantize it. And so then, apparently, Tiemann invented the Tiemann trick. And this is a nice way to rewrite, in principle, 1 over that q, but you also do that with this, together with this factor. And you rewrite it into terms which don't involve the inverse. Okay, there's a kappa. So kappa is reset to 1. And kappa comes from the Poisson brackets E, A, B, C. So you rewrite it with, using the Poisson bracket. And it turns out that it can be rewritten with this epsilon ABC as a Poisson bracket of the volume, which is a function of the triads, of a region which includes this point x. So it's a volume of a region including this point x and the connection. And so you would quantize now, you know, this is a hugely complicated expression to quantize. Like, any inverse function, you have basically no clue how to quantize. But this can be just quantized as a commutator. And so this is the basic idea. here. So you can consider, basically, for instance, a vertex with three edges. And you could guess that the curvature, as we did before, is quantized as a closed holonomy. e prime e, and then this would be a closed curve alpha e e prime. And also you need another path, p e e, which you need, which you call p e e prime, because it, for some funny reason. And this path will be basically this holonomy, which sits inside the Poisson bracket. And so for unitarity and for to have a gauge invariant expression, you don't just replace this with a holonomy, but you write this actually as h p e e prime h commutator of e e e prime here, the inverse of the holonomy volume of this region. And the volume of this region will be actually the volume which sits at this vertex. And so here it's important to take this combination, because then you get an gauge invariant expression, or an expression which at least is covariant. If you only take one HPE, you get something not transforming nicely. And so finally, having this picture, which went up there, you can quantize your constraint, Cn, as the sum over vertices of your spin network state, or of your graph. So you have a lapse function associated to the vertices, which means that you actually, for every vertex, you have one constraint, because you can just set this to one for a given vertex and set everything else to zero. You have a symmetry factor, which is just some numerical factor taking care of all the symmetrizations you had to do, which come up here. You sum over edge triples at your vertex at V. And so first you have this trace, which we already encountered. This is the holonomy giving you the curvature. And so instead of h minus 1, you actually write h minus 1, which gives you like 2 times the curvature and 2 order epsilon square, because one is exponential f and the other is exponential minus f. Yeah?
Question. When you read this Feynman trick, there's an index I. Is it contracted with somebody or?
Good question. Here.
It's just the i-th component of the object.
It's the C algebra of valued forms, and then it takes a commutator and from this so this is a curvature, and then you get this expression for this Poisson bracket identity. And I didn't told you yet, but you can quantize, there's a quantization of the volume operator. And so this would be equivalent to the quantization of the area operator, which you considered in the sum tutorial. And then you actually sum over cyclic permutations to make it more symmetric in your three edges. And you sum over all triples on this vertex, and so on. And so this is a Hamiltonian constraint. And going back to this picture, you have basically this choice here. You see, you add an holonomy along a curve which wasn't there before. And I mean, this you can again ask, this is a discretization, but you know, you can actually, because you did the spin network and the discretization adapted to your spin network, there's actually a well-defined limit in which you can take away this discretization. And this is, there's a lot to do with working with this diffeomorphism invariant states, where only, in principle, the connectivity of the graph matters. And so you have two choices. And so actually, Tiemann, so this original choice was to add these curves so that they indeed would change the graph or would add an edge to the graph. And you can do that because you can always first imagine that you have a j equal to 0 edge. And so I didn't told you, but you actually you have to decide, there's a j ambiguity in this Hamiltonian. You have to decide in which representation you take the holonomies. And so natural choice is j equal to 1/2. You would get, in any case, you get then this j equal to 1/2 additional edge. And so this is done here. It might change this. And then it's this thing is again taken away. So that doesn't do anything. So you get this graph change. Then you can ask, you know, what happens with the commutator? And it actually happens that these constraints with the commutator algebra of your constraints. And if you do it this way, it actually happens that the commutator algebra of your constraints turns out to be abelian. And the reason is that basically if you do something at this vertex and you do something at this vertex, and by definition, you always do it in this region, which, you know, doesn't touch any other vertex. They don't really speak to each other. And so these things are abelian. You could also ask, what happens if I apply Hamiltonian to one vertex and then the Hamiltonian again to the same vertex? And so the way it's defined is actually that you now would add a loop inside this other loop. So you would go nearer and nearer, just that the distance here doesn't really matter because it's also only the connectivity that matters. And here you have actually a new vertex. And you could ask, but I should also have an action on this new vertex. But in fact, it turns out that the Hamiltonian does not act on this vertex because the volume of this region turns out to be zero. So in this case, the constraints are basically abelian. And you can either see that as a bad thing or as a good thing. There is actually a reason why they should be abelian, because to make this all well defined, you have to work on the state, on the space of diffeomorphism invariant states. And in this case, you know, you would actually expect that the commutator of the Hamiltonians gives you a diffeomorphism constraint, but it should be zero on the space. However, it's very hard to deal with this feature. It's a feature which is completely unknown because it changes really in a sense. Also, you can make sense out of it. It changes the number of degrees of freedom. So it's very hard to deal with this constraint. And you could say, but let's do something more like standard gauge field, lattice gauge field theory. And in standard lattice gauge field theory, you know, people would say you would if you want to quantize your holonomy, you have to take an already existing loop, what we actually did in 3D. And you can do that. And this would basically make like the vertices really connected to each other. So in this case, you know, you would do these all these constraints here. The Hamiltonian doesn't act. And so in a sense, the Hamiltonians don't really speak to each other. Here you would do this and so on. Here you see that if you do this, this adding in holonomy, and then adding here in holonomy at this vertex, there's clearly something, you know, where these two vertices connect to each other. However, if you would do that, you would get very complicated constrained algebra. And it's not even constrained algebra. I mean, nobody actually, I don't think that anybody computed this. But here you would expect that the commutator of two Hamiltonians sitting at two different vertices is first, it's non-zero, but it's also not really, you wouldn't expect that it's proportional to a Hamiltonian constraint. So you would get the so-called anomalous algebra. And so this is indeed a discretization problem. However you spell anomalous. This is indeed a discretization problem, which also applies to, it applies in a similar form to lattice gauge theory concerning Lorentz symmetry. And, you know, it's actually this problem that here in principle, you want to do a continuum limit. And so what you would expect if you do a continuum limit, that at least these terms on the right-hand side go to zero. Or give you approach a consistent algebra at least. And so, yeah, that's what we have to think about, continuum limit. But the lecture is over. but so these are the main problems in if you want to work in 4D. And yeah, some people, I mean, there are some approaches which avoid this by so-called deparametrizing your theories. This is kind of gauge fixing your theories, and you don't need to think about your constraint algebra. But again, there's a similar problem in this, and this is again representing diffeomorphism symmetry. And in the end, this is quite important to really get rid of your discretization structure. So it's similar to, you know, this problem is similar that you actually want to write a discretization which in the end does not depend on the discretization. Or you don't want to depend things, to have things dependent on your regulator. And so some people argue that it's kind of equivalent to the renormalization problem. But actually here you have a well-defined procedure, or here have some prescription. And so the question is really how to use this prescription to make the continuum limit and to see what you get actually in this continuum limit. Okay. So there any more questions? Can we close for this? If you have any ideas how to solve these, let me know.